Okay, so we've been talking about the stages in the preparation of the bride. And we've said that there is this waiting period. And there is this period when the groom is preparing the room for the bride back at home. And the bride is preparing herself for the groom at her home. What does it mean for the bride to be prepared and ready for the groom when he comes to get her? How does the groom, Jesus, want to find us when he comes? Well, let me embarrass someone. Ali, what did you expect of Sarah, and what were your and were your expectations met on that wonderful day in early autumn last year?
I don't like using cliches, but you know, she looked as gorgeous as I'd ever seen her, and she was wonderful.
As gorgeous as you'd ever seen her, and she was wonderful, and that was your expectation. Do you know that is the expectation Jesus has of us when he comes for us? He wants us to be, he expects us to be as gorgeous as he's ever seen us. And actually, he expects us, just like Sarah did then, and just like other brides do on their day, to surpass those expectations. What does that mean? We've just sung the following verse. Finish then thy new creation. Pure and spotless, let us be. Let us see thy great salvation perfectly restored in thee. Pure and spotless, let us be. What does it mean to be pure and spotless? What does it mean for his creation, great salvation to be perfectly restored in us and in him? There's a verse in Philippians that said we should be letting him finish his work in us, working out our salvation with fear and trembling. Now, hang on a minute. I thought I was saved. I thought I was saved the moment I got down on my knees in 1970 and said, Lord God, forgive me of my sins. I want you to come into my life. Forgive me, save me. I will follow you from now on. I thought I was saved then. What does it mean that I have to work out my salvation with fear and trembling? Well, it doesn't mean I have to work hard in order to get saved to go to heaven. What it does mean is, because I am saved, I have to work out what that means in my life so that I come to fruition of what that means. Because it's possible that you get down on your knees when you're 12 in 1970 and you say, come to me, fill me, I want to be yours, I'm going to follow you. And basically, you don't do very much about it after that. You sort of say, I'm a Christian, and you live your life, but nothing much changes. And whether you've done that or not, to be honest, your life hasn't taken a particularly different course. And then you're going to get a shock the moment he comes for you. Because there's going to be an awful lot of changing happen very quickly for you to be ready at that instant when he comes. And it says in the Bible that actually, for some, it will be like passing through a fire. Because that's how you purify gold. You pass it through a fire, all the dross drops off. It's a fairly quick process. And for some, that purification is going to be a quick process because it's going to be, he's coming, and you're not ready. So there's going to be, in the process of being taken, which we call death, there's going to be a quick process of purification. And it's going to be a shock to your entire system. And there's going to be regrets of, oh, I could have done most of this. So to work out your salvation with fear and trembling is purifying, being pure, purified day by day as you live on this earth, focusing on who he is, what he wants, and how you become more like him. And that's what he calls us to do. To be a perfect bride ready for the groom to come. We do not know when the groom is coming. It might be at the point of our death. It might be at the point of this thing called the rapture at the end of time, Whenever. I've sort of forgotten about that recently, really, and sort of not been thinking much about Jesus coming back. But then arrived here the day before yesterday. It was only yesterday, wasn't it? Goodness me. And the guys were talking, not the guys that own the place, were talking about, the Antichrist is coming and it's getting very near the end and this and that and the other. And I was thinking, oh yeah, I used to think like that in 1975. I used to think, he's coming soon, etc. We have to be ready for him to come one way or other. He's going to come for us, and we're going to leave this earth. It might be in a box, and it might be in a flash, but he's going to come for us, and we have to be ready. What does it mean to be ready? Well, what does the groom expect of the bride? I just point out a few things. One thing they often talk about is the eyes. Her eyes were really sparkling. They were wide and ready and expectant, and the eyes show the beauty and all that sort of stuff. And the eyes often sparkle for her beloved. What does that mean? Well, I think it means that the focus is on the beloved, really. That actually she's there just for him, and she's looking at him, and when she sees him, because it's what she really wants, she is delighted by what she sees, and her face lights up. If, though, she'd been thinking the night before, I'm not really sure whether I want Cedric or Marmaduke, and Cedric is the person at the front of the aisle, and she sees him and she thinks, oh, I'm not sure if I've got the right choice, her eyes don't light up. It's because she's focused. It's because she's certain, it's because she knows this is what she wants, that her eyes light up and she has no distractions. So the first thing about the bride being ready is to know that Jesus is what you want. The first thing about the bride being ready is to not allow there to be other distractions and be thinking, well, I think I want Jesus, but I also want sex with practically everyone that walks past me before. Anyway, and I want a lot of money and I want a lot of riches, and those things are quite important. Oh, Jesus, oh, I'm not sure. The first thing about being ready is to be sure about what you want. Are you his or aren't you? And you might have said, I'm going to follow you, Jesus, come into my life, and all that stuff, but that was years ago. And actually, right now, if you're honest, you're not sure if that's really what you're living for. You've got distracted. He's been away preparing the room, and actually, there's a new boy moved in next door, to use that sort of analogy. He's been, you've become a Christian, and actually, you're a bit bored with singing the same old worship songs. And it'd be better to be down the nightclub on a Saturday night than in church on a Sunday. There's other things. Fix your eyes upon Jesus. The old Sunday school chorus, you won't know it because they don't do these things anymore. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Fix on him, the rest of it sort of fades away. When the bride sees her groom, when the bride sees her beloved and she fixes on him, she has forgotten about what is going on around her. If we're going to be prepared, if we're going to be ready, we need to be sure of who we're fighting, who we're aiming at, what we want, and deal with the distractions and cut them out. And to be ruthless about cutting them out. What is it that stops you focusing on him? Cut it out. Jesus said, very, very, very ruthlessly, if your eye causes you to sin, pull it out. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Now, he didn't actually physically mean that, but he was being ruthless and saying, deal with whatever distracts you. So if constantly seeing certain things distracts you from God, avoid those things ruthlessly, even if it makes you look stupid. There are people I've heard who are on diets, and they've changed their route home from work so they don't pass the bakery with a cream shop, cream cake shop, because they can't pass it without buying one. Now, people might think you're stupid. Why do you walk 2 miles home when your house is only half a mile from where you work? Because they are being ruthless. And we need to be that sort of ruthless if we're going to do it. A very old former TFG member, he is now nearly 40, I've been doing this for far too long, has just decided to cut out the thing that is costing him time with God. He has given back his iPhone. He is no longer having a mobile phone. That cuts me away from God, spends too much time on it, get rid of it. That's ruthless. I'm not saying that's what you have to do. He focused on that. That was a problem. Deal with it. What is it that we need to deal with if we're going to be ruthlessly ready and prepared? The second thing after the eyes is the heart, and the heart is what yearns for him. The heart is what yearns for something. What are our priorities? Not just what are the things that distract us now. What are our priorities? What's the most important thing for you in your life? Is it money, wealth, family, 2.4 kids, whatever? Live peacefully, live happy, be happy, all that rubbish. Is it God? Is it whatever God wants? Is it him? Are you prepared to make him your heart's desire, your main priority, the most important thing? This bride who was betrothed to the groom in the Jewish wedding behaved as if she was already married to him, even though they were physically separated by a distance for at least a year. She behaved as if she was already married. And we should behave as if we were already united with Christ in heaven. What does that mean? Two shall become one. Wherever you are, he is. Is where you are right now somewhere you're feeling comfortable with him being there with you? And that will be different for each of us, and we mustn't judge each other, really. Because for one person, being in the nightclub might be a very, very, very right place to be, because they're there with him, yeah, enjoying themselves, but also maybe being there for people who are broken. Because their focus isn't on boogieing the night away, but their focus is on being ready to serve God wherever they happen to be. But for another person, being in the nightclub might be the biggest distraction on earth. I've never been in one. I don't know what they're like. I can't tell you. I don't think they were invented when I was the right age. That's the individual.
Never too old.
Don't you believe it? That's the individual. But there's more. This person called the bride, as I said last night, is not individually us. It's corporately us. The bride corporately, the bride together needs to be prepared. The bride together needs to be ready. The bride together needs to be there waiting for him. What does that mean? Well, it means looking out for each other to some extent. We'll get into that a little bit more in a minute, but I want us to look at Hebrews chapter 10 if you have a Bible. If you don't, it'll be on the screen. But it'd be better if you've got one to look it up yourself. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 21 to 25, I think. If you're looking it up, you'll find Hebrews chapter 10 somewhere in the middle of the book of Hebrews. Towards the end of the Bible, it's the last big book before Revelation. They're all little thin ones apart from Hebrews. Okay, The most important verse, well, not the most important verses, but the verses I want to look at are 24 and 25, but just to set it in context. Since we have a great priest over the house of God, verse 22, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful, and let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds. Let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. So those are the two verses particularly I want to look at. Let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds, and let us not give up meeting together, but let us encourage one another all the more as you see the day approaching. We'll talk about that in a minute. But let's start with this bit about what it means to spur one another on towards love and good deeds. What normally gets spurred on? Horses. How do they get spurred on? Not with a whip, with spurs. How do you use spurs? Well, you basically kick them. You do use a whip as well, but the spurs... You basically got a sharp thing and you stick it in its belly. Okay, you want to use a whip, but we're talking about spurs. Okay, and not the football team because I don't want to waste my breath. So what we're talking about is actually something sharp banging into your belly. Spur each other on means being ready when necessary to give each other a sharp jab. Now, the problem with that is the first thing is you have to have a relationship with the one you're doing it to. You jump on any horse that you haven't got a relationship to and you kick it in its belly, it is liable to kick you off. Okay? You have to be a very good rider to get on a horse you haven't got a relationship to with and treat like that. You build up a relationship as you go along. So I'm told, I'm not a rider, but there you go. In other words, you can't just go up to random next Christian and say, someone you haven't got a relationship with, and say, oi you, you're doing that wrong, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that, God says this, God says that, I've blessed you, now I'm off. If you are in a relationship, we call it fellowship with people who love you and you love, then you have to get to that point of giving each other permission to spur each other on. But you have to be careful about doing it with people you're not in that relationship with, because horses kick back. And you're liable to get kicked back if you go up to someone and say, I don't think you should be doing that, or whatever. And it happens in churches. And it's a generational thing that happens. You go into a church and some older person might say, shouldn't be wearing a baseball cap. As if that's the most important thing about your holiness. Or, you know, how dare you come into church wearing shorts or flowery dresses or whatever. And I normally say sorry and I go and change. But if we have a relationship with someone, we have the right to go up to them and say, you know, we've given each other the right. We've got to that point, and we should give people permission to do that, because we should want to be spurred on to be loving and good deeds. And we'll come to that one in a minute as well. And that links in with the last verse, which says, don't give up the habit of meeting together, but let us encourage one another. There are too many Christians who say, I can be a Christian, I don't have to go to church. Well, you don't have to go to church if church means something with a steeple and an organ and pews and stuff like that. But you do have to be part of a fellowship of people who are, one, godly, and two, well-led. And by well-led, I mean not just a group of people who say, we don't like what any churches locally are doing, we'll get together and do whatever we want, because that's dodgy. Because part of the way God has the church set up is that it hands things on from one generation to the next generation to the next generation. So you need some generational stuff there in order to be able to be handing on. Otherwise, you're reinventing the wheel every time, and that's not good economy in God's kingdom. So though I'm not saying you shouldn't ever meet together just with other Christian friends who are your own age, I am saying you should be in a fellowship where there are people who are greyer than you are, and actually also more nappy wetting than you are. There should be younger ones and older ones. You should be passing things on, you should be receiving things. That's God's way of church. There are plenty of different styles, from hands raised to incense raised, but it's, you know, you find something that fits you as you are. But you should be part of something which is a fellowship lively. And in that, within that, not the whole bunch, but there will be some whom you have permission to spur on and who have permission to spur you on. There are lots of Christians who say, yeah, I'm really sure I want to follow God. I'm committed to following God. But there are some things I really like doing, and God doesn't really mind if I do this, because he will forgive me. Yeah, I know he had to die for it, but yeah, he's done that anyway. He'll forgive me. Let me go as far, let me stretch credibility far enough to say, okay, let's suppose God doesn't mind. What are you teaching the next generation? You're teaching them that that's okay. So they then assume that's all right. And then they do the next bit and they say, well, we'll stretch it a bit further. And my apologies to you, because that's what the generation above you and the generation above them, my lot, have done to you. The church is lukewarm because God doesn't really mind, was said in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And there isn't much sense of holiness in the church in this country, in the West. Can't speak for Norway. But there isn't much holiness in the church generally. It's coming back, but it was missing for ages. Because God doesn't really mind if we just do what the people around us do and we live secular, ordinary lives that cannot be seen as different to anyone else. And if the bride is going to be ready, she must be visibly different to the people around her. And what that means, well, I can't tell you exactly, but you know the things that God is saying, this is how I want you to live. And these are the things I want you to major on. And I want you to focus on me. So we should be sharpening each other, and we should be thinking about how I get sharpened. Who sharpens me? Is there someone who sharpens me? Caelan will know. But that's very often, if you're a leader, the people you're leading. You lot sharpen me. I'm not saying there's no one older than me that sharpens me, but that often happens. But you should know, who are the people that sharpen me, and who are the people I can go to when I just want to say, look, I'm struggling with this. I have a real problem. I'm, you know, can't stop going to see certain types of film or whatever. Help me. We should be visibly different in the things we do. One thing I want to shout about, I would love to see visibly different amongst Christians, is that eight-letter word which is new in the English language and probably now in the new dictionaries, which is spelt F-A-C-E-B-O-O-K. Because when I go on that, and I am not saying I'm great myself, because I don't really use it in the way that it's meant to be used. I go on it just to look and put some photos up to embarrass people. But when I go on that, I get messages flashed on my screen with things I don't want to see. And I look at who sent them. You know, so-and-so is effing unhappy today. Oh, look. Leading member of TFG. Or whatever. And I think, and I'm not just getting on about swearing, I just think, hey, this is such a valuable thing to make a difference. We could make a real difference with that. If Christians on there were actually, so I mean, one of the sixth formers is saying that now, instead of putting up, I have just been to the toilet, or I'm about to have dinner or stuff, he writes in that slot a different worship song or a different Bible verse every time he goes on Facebook. So it's just, I've got to have a Bible verse or a worship song to put up there every couple of hours I go on Facebook. That makes a difference. I'm not saying we should all do that, but I'm just saying, is our presence anywhere different to anybody else's? And that is a very clear way of looking at it and saying, is there a difference between how this person is using it and how that person is using it? And how does that relate to what we're doing in our ordinary lives? So corporately, we're responsible to what we're telling each other. Individually, we need to be focused, our eyes and our heart. Let me take you back to an imaginary scene in Nazareth in about 20 AD. It's party night in the town. There's a great celebration going on, and the young guys are out looking for the pretty girls to take to the hoedown, or whatever they called them in those days. Okay?
No, I genuinely don't know what a hoedown is.
A hoedown is a hillbilly barn dance. All right?
Oh, okay.
Okay. So you basically put your hose down, I think, is what, you know, the HOE farming implement down.
Because to me, a hoe isn't a
I know. I just realised where we're going and I'm going to stop right now. Anyway, back to Nazareth for the dance night. Whatever. Yes, the young guys of the town are out to take the pretty girls to the dance. But for Janiah, there's no party tonight because she is betrothed to Cephas. She could go, but she doesn't even notice the distraction, actually, because she's focused on being ready for him, and he might come tonight for her. So although there's excitement in the town, and although actually there's nothing wrong in going, it's not sin to go to a party, for her, it's a distraction. She might miss the important thing if she goes. And this is the hard bit, because it's not just sin we've got to avoid. It's the things that distract us from Jesus, which other people can do, and it's not wrong for them. But actually, it might be wrong for you. There's a guy in the Bible called Samuel. If he had had his hair cut, it would have been a sin. For most of us, it is not a sin to have our hair cut. Samson, doesn't matter, began with Sam, and I'm getting old. There's a guy in the Bible called Samson, and for him to have his hair cut, it would have been a sin. Because he made a vow to God, and said, I will never cut my hair as a sign of this. So it was just a personal thing between him and God. But once he'd done it, if he had ever had his hair cut, it would have been a sin. It's not a sin for anyone else. And there are sins of Samson God wants us to cut out. And what I mean by that is, there are things he says, I do not want you doing that. Even if every brother and sister in the church you're part of go and do it, you are not going to do it. Neither are you going to judge them for doing it, and neither are you going to point the finger and say, I'm holier than you because I don't do that. Ouch. My leg just pulled. But there are times when we just say, actually, I'm not doing that. That's wrong. God has told me not to do that. There was a time for me, and this is not to big me up, it's just to give you an example. God basically told me I must never point a gun at anyone. You might think, well, that's stupid. But no, there are toy guns, you know, and I wasn't to play with toy guns and point them at people. I did as a kid, but this was when I was a bit older. Great! Somewhere in the early 1990s, someone invented something called Laser Quest, and all my Christian friends wanted to go to Laser Quest. And they did, but I couldn't go. And I couldn't tell them why I couldn't go. Because I couldn't point a gun at someone and point it. I'm rather glad about it now because paintballing, I hear, hurts, and I'm not going to do that because there's a good reason not to do it, but I don't get hurt either, so that's quite good. But Laser Quest didn't hurt, and it sounded like good fun. So it's that sort of thing where you've made a sort of promise to God about something, And even though it's all right for others, if you're focused, you're not going to do it. And that's where you really begin to see, am I there? Am I focused on God? Or am I letting these distractions in? So corporately, we're responsible for each other and we should be meeting with each other, and we shouldn't be slipping from meeting with each other, and we should be having a group who spur us on and we spur on. And individually, it's where our eyes are focused on. Are we focused on Him so that we light up when thoughts of Him come along? What our priorities and what our desires are. That's what it means, I think, to be the bride of Christ ready. How ready are we? How focused are we? How distracted are we? Let's just spend a few minutes in quiet. How ready are we? How ready are you? How focused are we? How focused are you? How distracted are we? How distracted are you?